Classified, ultra secret, Air Force generals only. Ten hut! At ease, men, take your seat.
This is General Curtis Goathart. If you are viewing this film, then we are under extraterrestrial attack. Beware, your brain may no longer be the boss. If you are beginning to doubt what I am saying, you are probably hallucinating. Listen carefully.
What to do if an alien appears? One.
Drop under the seat of your plane and look away.
Two.
Avoid eye contact.
Three.
If there are no eyes, avoid all contact.
How to identify alleged sightings? One.
Pie plates, or as reflections in the atmosphere.
Two.
Dry cleaning bags filled with marsh gas, or...
Three.
Mass insanity.
How to inform your wife and others under your command.
Can I freshen that up for you?
I don't know how she got that requisition.
Oh, she gets it. She gets it in the car.
Well, she's not allowed to have it unless she...
Honey,
she's related to the...
Honey,
he's like a PX, though.
Well, General?
Honey and men, I have something awesome to reveal to you.
Well, go ahead, sir.
Go ahead.
Two flying saucers have just landed on my plate.
Well, turn away, sir. I'll eat them.
Good thing.
Men, our greatest fear is realized. We are under attack from superior consciousness.
The eggs, sir?
They're only the beginning.
Well, that's
all right, men. Questions?
Sir?
Yes, Major?
Pass the syrup, General?
It's over here.
That's a good idea, Chuck. But syrup won't stop them.
But,
next.
Sir?
Colonel?
Are you nuts?
That is just exactly what they want you to believe.
The, eggs, sir?
Let's just call them the phenomena.
Well, if I may respectfully submit, sir, I think you've got your phenomena scrambled, General.
What about my eggs, dear?
Honey, they're in everybody's eggs.
Good Lord.
You're making me cry, General. Perhaps you'd like to... Another cup of coffee, sir. Settle down a bit.
Conclusion!
They think he is insane, yet he outranks them. His option, command.
What?
He seals off the area.
Two.
Secures the cooperation of local officials.
Three.
Obtains expert scientific assistance.
Four.
Evacuates all government employees.
Five.
And bombs aliens back to Stonehenge.
End of film.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just catching up with us, we're listening to Should the U.S. Break Up the Big Banks? And the debaters are Richard Fisher, Simon Johnson, Douglas Elliott, and Paul Saltzman.
All right, let me bring in Paul Saltzman.
Yeah, no, look, it's been waiting for the moment to address this fictitious subsidy question. There's no subsidy, okay?
Oh.
There's no transference of wealth.
I used to love you. I don't love you anymore.
Richard, there is no subsidy. There is no empirical evidence to suggest that any taxpayer dollars are currently being transferred for the benefit of big banks. You're throwing out the term subsidy and creating this argument as if it's the agricultural industry that gets taxpayer dollars. What you're talking about, just to put it in the context, is allegations or assertions that banks... somehow large banks borrow at funds cheaper than would otherwise be the case because of market perceptions that they will be bailed out.
Which seems like a quite reasonable and logical argument.
It's just not true.
Well,
okay, it's just not true. Okay. Secondly, evidence suggests that large institutions borrow with cheaper funds because they're larger. They issue more debt. They have liquidity premiums. Coca-Cola borrows more cheaply than RC Cola. Would you suggest breaking up Coca-Cola or calling that a subsidy? The fact of the matter is the deposit liability structure of banks is very complex, and it's impossible to assess how and when cost of funds differentials are attributable to the too-big-to-fail issue that you're
mentioning. Simon Johnson.
It's just simply not true.
Paul, you just summarized very nicely all the industry papers, the papers written by people who work for the big banks on this topic. If we look at the independent research, including at a workshop at NYU that you helped to organize last week, There were two very good papers by independent academics and groups of academics at that workshop just last week that showed there are substantial subsidies of the too big to fail kind that exactly we've been talking about. That was your own conference, Paul. Why are you ignoring that evidence?
Why are you ignoring Randy Krosner's paper, former governor of the Federal Reserve
Randy
Bank?
Krosner's paper.
Why are you ignoring
Randy
Loretta
Krosner's,
Mester's paper?
Randy Krosner's,
why are you ignoring all the papers that are against you? That's what you do, Simon.
Randy Krosner.
You simply ignore everything that's against you. And
by
you
the way,
embrace
everybody got the
you.
Package of the papers. Right? Sir, right down front.
My name is Fred Deutsch. To the side opposed, if your position is that the scale and scope of J.P. Morgan allows it to be the most efficient compared to the smaller banks, why is it that J.P. Morgan is not the low-cost mortgage provider in New York and can't execute international trade as efficiently as the smaller banks with whom we do business?
Doug Elliott.
Sure. First of all, here you're talking about one specific example. Every bank's going to have strengths and weaknesses. I don't think that the big strength of the banks we're talking about is their retail business. Where I see the more compelling case is where you're talking about doing things that smaller banks just really can't do, period. International trade, I'm not sure I could answer that. I'm sure there are people who would argue they do a nice job. I don't know enough about it.
So they're really good at managing big, complex derivative transactions in London. I think that was the answer.
And that concludes round two of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, where our motion is break up the big banks. On to round three, closing statements. Our motion is this, break up the big banks. And here to summarize his position against this motion, Paul Saltzman, president of the Clearinghouse Association. Ladies and gentlemen, Paul Saltzman.
I know you've heard a lot of facts and figures and contradictory assertions, but let me ask you to just consider three simple practical facts. I ask you to remember that America needs global banks, and it reflects the global economy in which we live. Unlike any era before, we live in a global economy. It's clear that our economy requires these international banks to support customers. The only question is whether America will sit on the sidelines or be part of that. Today, just four of the world's largest 25 banks are American banks. To break them up and reduce that number to zero jeopardizes America's leadership in the world and America's global leadership. I ask that you keep in mind that we can't roll back the clock. I know it's natural after the kind of disaster that we faced and the turmoil that we've all experienced to yearn for more simpler, less complex times. But the American economy that was once served exclusively by small banks just no longer exists. The good old days weren't that good. The S&L crisis, the Great Depression, all were caused by systemic risks associated with smaller banks. Rolling back the clock to restructure the banking system isn't realistic, and it simply wouldn't make us safer. In closing, I know it feels good, but I submit that breaking up the big banks would create a host of new problems and solve almost none. We can do better, and we should. Please vote no and oppose the proposition. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul Saltzman. Our motion is break up the big banks, and here to speak in summary in support of this motion, Richard Fisher, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Fisher.
Thank you. I would submit that America needs competition. I would submit that America needs a level playing field. I would submit that America never again wants to expose its taxpayers to bailing out institutions that made bad decisions because they were badly managed. And they were encouraged, basically, to achieve a size and scale under the protection of the law. I therefore strongly endorse taking action that would cordon off the guarantees we provide to these mega financial institutions and just make them subject to the same competitive rules that affect all other businesses. I ask you to support our motion to break up the too-big-to-fail banks. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard Fisher. And that is our motion, break up the big banks. And here to speak against the motion in his closing statement, Doug Elliott, a fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution. Ladies and gentlemen, Doug Elliott.
Thank you, John, and thank you, everyone, for the opportunity. This is an important question. The overall objectives you've described, Richard, and I think Simon, we would agree with. I'd focus on 2 points why I don't agree with your actual proposal. First is, I'm still a little unclear exactly what it is and how it relates to the actual thing we were supposed to debate. And for me, that's an important point. But beyond that, I do believe from the years of experience I had working in the industry that the customers really have seen major advantages. And I do want to say, Richard, early on, you were describing bankers who were deliberately creating excessively large firms for the sake of being excessively large, opaque firms for the sake of maximizing the subsidies. I worked in M&A, in finance, working with financial institutions. I never once in the 20 years ever talked to anybody who, even in private conversations, had any of those things as their objectives. Now, I can understand if you want to make the argument that the incentive structure pushes things that way, but I would strongly urge backing away from language that both of you at times have used that argues that the bankers are deliberately trying to create their firms in such a way that they get these subsidies. I think I'll leave it there. I'd urge you to vote against the motion.
Thank you very much, Doug Elliott. And that is our motion, break up the big banks. And here to summarize his position in support of the motion to break up the big banks, Simon Johnson, former chief economist at the IMF, professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management. Ladies and gentlemen, Simon Johnson.
In 1902, the administration of Teddy Roosevelt brought an antitrust action against Northern Securities, a very large railroad company. It was one of the first actions of its kind. It was extremely controversial. A lot of people in the mainstream didn't know what Roosevelt was doing. There were plenty of arguments made that these monopolies were modern, they were efficient, they would benefit the American economy. J.P. Morgan, the original J.P. Morgan, the man, came to the White House in February 1902, and he said to Roosevelt and to his attorney general, "If we've done anything wrong, send your man to see my man, and we'll fix it up." And Roosevelt and his attorney general, thank goodness, said, "No, we don't want to fix it up. We want to stop it." This, in Roosevelt's mind, was an excessive concentration of power. They took that case all the way to the Supreme Court. They won it 4-3, and out of that came a lot more precedents, antitrust cases, more legislation, and, I would submit, the really important change was a shift in the consensus. In 1911, when the government moved to break up Standard Oil, there were very few defenders of huge monopolies. People understood concentrated power can be very damaging in this democracy. Vote for the democracy. Vote to break up the big banks. Thank you.
Thank you, Simon Johnson. And that concludes our closing statements. I also want to say this about this debate. It was really terrific. These debaters obviously feel passionate about this. They have a shared common ground, but they had very, very honest disagreements that were honestly argued. And I want to congratulate them for the way they did this tonight. All right, the results are in now. Our motion is this: break up the big banks. We have had you vote twice, both before the debate and once again after the debate. Remember, the team whose numbers have changed the most in percentage point terms will be declared our winner. Here was the result of the preliminary vote on the motion, break up the big banks, before the debate. 37% of you agreed with this motion. 19% were against. 44% were undecided. So those are the first results. Remember, the team that moves the numbers the most from first vote to second is declared our winner. Here is then the second vote. The team arguing for the motion, their second vote was 49%. From 37% to 49%, that is an increase of 12 percentage points. That is the number to beat. The team against the motion, and their first vote was 19%. Their second vote, 39%. That's 20 percentage points above. They did it. The team arguing against the motion has won this debate. Break up the big banks. Congratulations to them, and thank you for me, John Donvan, and Intelligence Squared US. We'll see you next time.
Hear great speeches and interviews at AXA Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Howard Dean Quixote, the man of Vermontia.
I'm Dean, the impossible Dean. I'm back on the national stage. I'll go to each state that we lost in. For stop is the state of enraged. that I will run again
and fight
for the presidency. Someday I will run this great country, for now it's the great DNC. That's why the left is counting on me. I never drink decaf, and I'm an MD. But with the state of my party, it said that they don't need a doctor, they need a mortician instead. And I know there are folks who will say I don't have a full deck. And it's weird, but it sometimes appears that I don't have a neck. And the world will get better, or else I might get a little extreme. For now, here's just what you're expecting. I'll scream the impossible. Scream!
Casey was a good boy. He treated people well. And his mama loved him. Anyone could tell. She'd send him off to school, pack his lunch with care. When he came back home, she hugged him with her fingers in his hair. Cindy, she loved Casey, and when all is said and done, she is every mother, and he was every mother's son. When Casey was a little older, he spent his time each week in that church in Vacaville, in the service of the meek, in the service of his city, in the service of the Lord, with his mama in the pews, all the time they could afford. And if their love alone could save us, then the world would be one. She is every mother, and he was every mother's son. People thought the priesthood was where he'd someday be, so some folks were surprised when he joined the army. The recruiter told him he wouldn't have to fight. Cindy hoped this was the case, prayed for him every night. That was before they sent him to the desert with a gun. She is every mother, and he was every mother's son. His truck had no armor, and when it came under fire, it and half the soldiers in it became a funeral pyre. Cindy, she was sleeping the moment Casey died, and she knew she'd never see him standing by her side. There was no consolation, no safe place she could run. She is every mother, and he was every mother's son. The president, he told her he died for a noble cause, but Cindy's wondering exactly what that was. Since they never found the weapons, now that Casey's gone, it seems that oil is the game, and Casey was the pawn. Cindy's got some questions, and so does everyone, because she is every mother, and he was every mother's son.
Appetite for destruction can't be easy to defend. When all your heroes have abandoned you, or have you abandoned them? From civilians to enemies, bombs can't discern. They just destroy all in their path. Will we ever learn? How many Iraqis per gallon? On this endless killing spree, how many kids can you kill and send a lower class the bill so you can drive your kids to soccer practice in your SUV? Whatever happened to your resolve? How did you join their ranks? Afraid of some Arab who can't even find reverse on a Russian tank. When the whole wide world is watching and they think that you're absurd. From Canada to East Asia, they're giving you the bird. How many Iraqis per gallon? On this endless murder spree, how many people can you kill and send the working class the bill so you can drive your kids to soccer practice in your SUV? Don't you read the news and not just CNN? There are other news outlets not owned by our government. You can call me left-wing liberal, or you can call me communist. But are you totalitarian or just an anarchist? Go and follow your false prophet, that lying greedy man who doesn't have the intellect to run a hot dog stand. How many Iraqis per gallon on this endless murder spree? How many kids can you kill? Send the working class the bill so you can drive your kids to soccer practice in your SUV. In your SUV. In your SUV. In your SUV.
Coming up next, Winston Churchill talks about the threat of Nazis in 1934. At the time, he was the Prime Minister of Great Britain.
Many people think that the best way to escape war is to dwell upon its horrors and to imprint them vividly upon the minds of the younger generation. They flaunt the grisly photographs before their eyes. They fill their ears with tales of carnage. They dilate upon the ineptitude of generals and admirals. They denounce the crime and insensate folly of human strife. Now, all this teaching ought to be very useful in preventing us from attacking or invading any other country, if anyone outside a madhouse wished to do so. But how would it help us if we were attacked or invaded ourselves? That is the question we have to ask. Would the invaders consent to visit Lord Beaverbrook's exhibition or listen to the impassioned appeals of Mr. Lloyd George? Would they agree to meet that famous South African, General Smuts, and have their inferiority complex removed in friendly, reasonable debate? I doubt it. I have borne responsibility for the safety of this country in grievous times. I gravely doubt it. But even if they did, I'm not so sure we should convince them and persuade them to go back quietly home. They might say, it seems to me, you are rich, we are poor, you seem well fed, we are hungry, you have been victorious, we have been defeated. You have valuable colonies, we have none. You have your navy, where is ours? You have had the past, let us have the future. Above all, I fear, they would say, you are weak and we are strong. After all, my friend, only a few hours away by air, there dwells a nation of nearly 70 million of the most educated, industrious, scientific, disciplined people in the world, who are being taught from childhood to think of war as a glorious exercise and death in battle as the noblest fate for man. There is a nation which has abandoned all its liberties in order to augment its collective strength. There is a nation which, with all its strength and virtue, is in the grip of a group of ruthless men preaching a gospel of intolerance and racial pride, unrestrained by law, by parliament, or by public opinion. In that country, all pacifist speeches, all morbid war books are forbidden or suppressed, and their authors rigorously imprisoned. From their new table of commandments, they have omitted, "Thou shalt not kill." It is but 20 years since these neighbors of ours fought almost the whole world and almost defeated them. Now they are rearming with the utmost speed, and ready to their hands is this new lamentable weapon of the air, against which our navy is no defense, and before which women and children, the weak and frail, the pacifist and the jingo, the warrior and the civilian, the frontline trenches and the cottage home, all lie in equal and impartial peril. Nay, worse still, for with the new weapon has come a new method, or rather has come back the most brutish method of ancient barbarism, namely the possibility of compelling the submission of races by terrorizing and torturing their civil population. And worst of all, the more civilized a country is, the larger and more splendid its cities, the more intricate the structure of its social and economic life, the more it is vulnerable, the more it is at the mercy of those who may make it their prey. Now these are facts, hard, grim, indisputable facts, and in face of these facts, I ask again, what are we to do?
And now for something completely different.